we're going to talk about relationship story, and I want to expand in a couple of directions on either side of what's in the curriculum to look at, it'll come up, but I want to especially talk about the relationship with your client and then expand a little bit about other aspects of relationship. So first, what really matters in terms of relationship? We know the best predictor of human happiness is human relationships, the quality, connection, and time that people spend with family and friends. We know that it's significantly more important than money and somewhat more important than health. These findings are summarized in Dr. Dan Gilbert's book, Stumbling on Happiness. Positive human contact, passion, joy, connection, love create long-term happiness more than what happens in our portfolio. Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman of Princeton surveyed over 1,000 American men and women to discern what most correlated with happiness and contentment. Heading the list, far and away, nurturing relationships. In a number of studies encompassing people of many cultures, the most satisfying core feature of optimal human experience was nurturing relationships. So let's look a bit at the influence of relationships. Neuroscience demonstrates that emotion can spread from brain to brain, actually from amygdala to amygdala. Emotional attitudes, disposition, and states of mind are all contagious. This kind of contagion can occur without people even being aware of it. It occurs amygdala to amygdala, mirror neuron function is involved. An example, neuroeconomists studied pairs of people using fMRI scans of their brains when they were interacting with each other. The brain state and emotion of one is mirrored by the other. In fact, when two people are in a harmonious synchrony back and forth, their brain waves form a synchrony like a symphony. There's a corresponding movement in both as soon then as one stops listening or there's an empathic rupture, this synchronous movement stops immediately. Here's a finding in another direction. Dr. Nicholas Christakis of Harvard Medical School followed 12,067 people for 32 years. And here is a summary of some of his findings. If your close friends are obese, your risk of obesity is 45% higher. If your good friend becomes obese, it increases your chance of becoming obese by 57%. If your friend's friends are obese, your risk is 25% higher even if you have never met them. Now, these studies parallel the Framingham study in medicine showing that clusters of friends show a contamination in things ranging from the induction of obesity, happiness or unhappiness, drinking, smoking, health, exercise, nutrition. Some explanation. One explanation is birds of a feather flock together, homophily. A norm or behavior can spread from one person to another by behavioral contagion and mirror neurons. Christakis said, you change your ideal of what is acceptable in terms of, for example, body type by looking at the people around you or what you invest in or what you wear. We imitate the behavior of others consciously and unconsciously. So what can we learn from this social contagion of behavior? One possibility is that when someone in a group does a good thing, publicize it. If 80% of a team submits travel reports on time, be sure the other 20% hear about it. If 76% of employees sign up for automatic retirement plan contribution, publicize it. Social networks can influence practices of wealth accumulation, including things like wellness and situations, as you know, from market fluctuations to product adoption. I have in one of my blogs that's archived the effect of someone who's eating alone, eating with one or two other people, eating with a group, and how much it affects how much consumption someone has. huge differences. Marketers recognize this contagion of popularity for commercial products by identifying thought leaders who spread the word and do viral marketing. So here's another example of this. A study in San Diego, researchers hung 4 flyers on doorknobs. One told homeowners that they should conserve energy because it helped the environment. One said saving energy was socially responsible. One said it saved money. The 4th said the majority of neighbors in the community are doing it. The researchers found that the 4th flyer, the majority of neighbors in the community are doing it, showed more change than all 3 others put together. Simply urging people, telling them it's a good idea, giving them the facts to recycle or conserve energy was the least effective. Now, let's revisit, in order to look at the coach-client relationship, empathy as a listening perspective. Empathy is a listening perspective inside the experience of another. It's our ability, as we've discussed before, to place one foot in the shoe of another, to resonate with someone else's experience, including how that person thinks, feels, constructs meaning, how they communicate. To know, in other words, as much as possible, their subjective reality, and to not get lost there, to keep one foot in our shoe. Now, a footnote here. When someone carefully crafts a speech or tells a story, the art is to allow the emotional response to reside in the reader or the listener. Rather than expressing it yourself, telling someone how they should respond, you facilitate the person to have his or her own experience. We can learn from the poets to give it to the reader or listener to experience themselves. Now, I want to move to focus on the coach-client relationship because there are aspects that I don't see anywhere else, and I believe they're important to you in getting, keeping, and benefiting clients. We've touched on this so far in looking at the process and in looking at attachment patterns. I believe this can make a big difference in your effectiveness. Now, we're taught as coaches to address the content, the agenda, intentions, actions, goals, and we discuss beliefs, behavior, and performance. I want to focus on the process. It's what's happening while you're talking about something else. It's not simple. It's not linear. But our clients will tell us several things: what's most important, what their needs are, what's beneficial, and what's not. For this, we have to listen very carefully and listen to various forms of communication, including the process of what comes alive within the relationship of coach and client. In fact, the previously uncoachable client may be the one who's been unheard at the level of need expressed, or has subtly gotten the coach to respond in a way that reiterates an old pattern. For example, the coach gets frustrated in the same way that others have in engaging the client. New addition, old story. Or a client may recreate the same process as with others, presents confusion about how to proceed, ambivalence, and reluctance to move ahead. The coach finally ends the uncertainty and suggests an action. The result, the old story is recreated, and a kind of codependency is formed in which someone else functions for the client. Now, these clients may be better understood in a different model that offers a more optimum responsiveness. So here's another example of what I mean by process. Clients know what they need, though not perhaps in conscious, logical, daytime language. They will try in every way possible to let us know what it is like to be them, to activate the aspects of their experience needing to be addressed in a coaching venue, in a here and now model. Not that they're trying, they just can't help it. It's what happens. We have to read this story accurately and guide the co-creation of a new story. And remember, for the client, it's not the old story. It's not their story. It's reality. It's the way things are. Now, this, I believe, is what Carl Jung referred to when he talked about the strong influence on the children of the unlived life of the parent. So, We gather as information while not taking it personally some of these kinds of unspoken subtext from clients. Self-statements, although at times stated directly as if it were about the mentor coach. A wish or fear. Well, you've got the answers, or man, you don't have any answers either. Disappointed recognition. I don't think you know about this any more than I do. Hope. You're the greatest. The unspoken subtext, so I too can become great. Feelings. To use as information now and to move toward a goal, not to go backward and to be understood as if in an old story. And finally, the second no that always means yes, or one would have been sufficient. As coaches, we listen carefully, simply, literally. Deepest truths are clothed in the simplest of garments. We believe what said the first time before other words get in the way. We hear somatic language literally and symbolically, the rumbling stomach that whispers swallowed pain, hypertension, a pain in the neck. The role of storyteller and listener unfolds on the shared lap of the mentor-coaching relationship. Part of the experience of story making is the feel, the safety, the trust, the ambiance of connectedness, the resonance of voice as well as words with a knowing receiver, confidential, collaborative. As Lily Tomlin said, he listened with an intensity most people have only while talking. The message contains the message. The message is a full and valid communication to be understood in its own right before the venue is changed. And that is, the immediate communication and experience of a client yields initial understanding before looking at what the client is trying not to say may really mean or where he wants to go. For example, often a client will say as a first sentence what she needs to do in that session. And I've had the opportunity to see this play out hundreds, a few thousand actually, of training sessions as mentor coach and dean of curriculum at Coach Training Alliance. A couple of examples. Well, I know I should just say no and stay on track, but here's the struggle I have with time management. Now, that's a billboard for an agenda. It's not a drop-off comment. And it's the answer, but it's going to take the client a session to get back to that answer and own the answer. I should just say no at times. Another example. I worked with an executive who began with, well, I know I'm going to have to dissolve this partnership, but here's the situation. Toward the end of the session, he said, this is great. You've helped me see exactly what I need to do and strategize to end the partnership. I then played back for him his own acknowledgement in the beginning, his first sentence of the session, and summarized the process of insights he had through the session so that he could really make it his own. My purpose was to help him internalize the process, the model, so that ultimately he wouldn't need me to do it. So it's not enough to construct a new experience. We need to help a client create and formulate a new model in which to understand and incorporate those new experiences, the P of the roadmap. This new model, this container of present and template for the future, is hope personified. It's a collaborative immersion of mentor, coach, and client. The past and present are never more distinguishable than at the very moment they're juxtaposed. This is the new story, now and next, present and future. Now, as a footnote, I want to borrow a concept from analysis, psychoanalysis, and talk about it briefly to show the usefulness in mentor coaching. Transference is the repetitive ways of organizing current experiences based on past experiences. Transference is the organizing process of how we perceive, process, and attach meaning to people and experiences. It simply means we use software developed in the past to read a current experience. It's the combined neural lexicon of repetition and self-statement. There's a little bit of background noise. Could I get you to mute? You're probably not hearing it. but your receiver is picking it up. Mute is star six. Now, sometimes this is helpful because it allows, many times it's helpful because it allows us to use vast experience in order to quickly read and respond to situations. But at times it can be limiting because past perceptions and solutions can become outdated. Transference is a playground of repetitions and of past experiences with important people as well. The old story will get activated. It will come alive alongside the new story being created. In mentor coaching, we focus specifically on the new story. We don't bother the old story until it bothers us. That is, we don't engage it. If necessary, we address the belief or the assumption just enough to cleave the old story from the past to refocus on the new, evolving, co-created story. Now, a couple of kinds of memories are activated as process, explicit or factual, and implicit or procedural, like a relationship pattern, an attachment pattern. The mentor-coaching relationship will activate the behavior patterns of the client. This offers an opportunity to understand and retranscript patterns of feeling, thought, self-regulation, and behavior. We continually help the client distinguish the old story from the new. Here are a couple of quotes from one of my favorite authors that summarizes this. The mind is author of internal assumptions, producer of the individual life drama, and casting director of significant others. The other quote, models of relationships with others will get established very early in life and become the software through which subsequent relationships are perceived, organized, and processed. At least until adulthood, the software is not viewed as one way of looking at things, but as the reality, as the way things are. A fish cannot describe water. It cannot get outside the system in order to do so. Now, both are from my last professional book as an analyst in 2002, Integrating Body Self and Psychological Self, Creating a New Story in Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. Now, this is the basis of what I mean when I say, don't take it personally. And the client is always showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. Now, it takes two real people for this co-created immersion to occur. The mentor coach must come to know how the client feels, senses, perceives, and processes experiences moment by moment, frame by frame. The meaning attached from the past story needs to be constantly examined in terms of usefulness in the new story. This also means that the client allows himself to use the mentor coach in a way to simultaneously be inside the old and the new stories. So, in this regard, let's look at mindset now and the role that that plays. We each have a running account of what's happening to us, what it means, what we should do. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. So, mindsets frame the ongoing account of how we interpret, process, and determine what we do. Mindsets are powerful beliefs of the stories about ourselves. Let me give you a couple of, in a very simple way of thinking about it, two mindsets that play a big role in coaching because when we hear one of the mindsets, the fixed mindset, every time we hear it, I believe it's a coachable moment. So this is a simple example of growth mindset versus fixed mindset. The view you adopt can significantly affect the way you live your life. So first, growth mindset. This is based on the belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You become open to accurate information about talents and abilities. You use it to adjust and grow. Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. The growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved throughout life, that anyone can change and grow through experience and application. You can even change how intelligent you are. Now, contrast that with fixed mindset. Those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal is to prove oneself in the classroom, later in a career, or in a relationship. The fixed mindset requires proving yourself again and again. It's kind of like being on a treadmill. You never quite get there. Each situation calls for a confirmation of intelligence or personality or character. The repeated internal questions are, will I succeed or fail? Will I look smart or dumb? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I be a winner or loser? Yet with a fixed mindset, no amount of confirmation can dislodge the hypothesis of mediocrity or the need for proof. A fixed mindset makes you preoccupied with how you're going to be judged versus a growth mindset focusing on improvement. So these are some of the characteristics of a fixed mindset. And every one of these, I believe, is a coachable moment. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how smart you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem include assigning blame or making excuses. Now, beliefs are often not conscious, but you can pay attention to them and hear them. And we can nudge someone toward a growth mindset. What can you learn from this? How can you improve? Here's an example that I want to share of the impact of belief and mindset. 105 Israeli soldiers participated in a 15-week commander training program. In this study, neither the trainers nor the trainees had any idea a test was being conducted. The training officers were informed outside the participants' awareness that each soldier had been classified into one of three categories of command potential. The training officers were required to know each of the soldiers' personal data as well as their command potential category. At the end of 15 weeks, the new soldiers took a written test to measure their new knowledge of the variables they had learned in training. And remember, they were all of equal ability, but they were assigned randomly and artificially to one of three command potential categories. So here are the findings. The soldiers who the training officers thought had a high command potential performed significantly better on the test. Their average score was 60 compared to the medium counterpart of 65, a huge difference just between the highest and the medium. The training officers' beliefs in the participants made a significant difference in their performance. They lived into the belief of them. Here's one more example. The same process occurred in a Yale study of senior citizens. In a longitudinal study, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over the three-year course of their study, a three-year period. For example, there was a significant drop in the hearing test score in this three-year period equivalent to 8 years of normal aging based on their belief, on their negative beliefs. Negative feelings about old age can make someone physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, and cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. They lived into their beliefs, or they died into them. Now, one thing that I want to talk about here is about instinct and prejudice. We have to distinguish our blink, our instinctive thin slicing of data to quickly come to a conclusion, at times from buried prejudice. In other words, our intuition from prejudice. It seems like an easy distinction. Deep within our unconscious, we have connections that can only be called biases, even when we consciously abhor them. We each hold a collection of stereotypical beliefs and attitudes about social groups, for example, that exist both without our permission and without our awareness. These beliefs color perceptions, expectations, and decisions. and can find their way into the process of the mentor-coaching relationship, which is why I'm mentioning here. The assorted stereotypical notions about social groups range from male, female, black, white, elderly, young, gay, straight, fat, thin, just to name a few. Regardless of our conscious desire to avoid the bias of stereotypy, these attitudes can shape the contours of our daily decisions. So we need to know if these stereotypes are buried deep in our psyches without our permission or our awareness. The meaning that we attach to what we perceive determines its emotional impact. So by changing the meaning, we can change the emotional impact. With awareness, we can even alter our response to emotional contagion from someone else. Of all variables to study, that have been studied to address bias and overcome prejudice, the strongest correlation with overcoming a prejudice is a powerful emotional bond. The register of social ostracism and rejection occurs in the same node of the brain that registers pain. Strong emotional bond, the oxytocin from that bonding experience, overcomes this, but it has to be also coupled with awareness. There are many learning laboratories for positive connections, including friends, colleagues, mentors. Research suggests, but mostly our experience simply informs, that we can develop awareness, that we can reshape implicit attitudes and belief, that we can adjust biases, that is, develop new life and relationship stories. The mentor, coach, and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows a distinction of old versus new in the evolving new story. We are always teaching others how to respond to us. Your client is always teaching you what it is like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so you can teach it back to her out loud. We must be open to that learning and not let our theories or our agenda get in the way, although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing. We continuously need to bridge that experience and system of meaning to the clients. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. What do our clients really want from us? I believe what our clients want from us as mentor coaches is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so we can give it back to its creator as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become, and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I stole that from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it because I like it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process. To hope that we will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in his process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. Invention has been sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in the old story, repeating the same storylines. We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe that the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and change-making experiences that the client has ever had. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is, does it work? Mentor coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence possible. An ideal co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily, to consider, to contemplate, to celebrate. Now, just a few words about coaching with couples. There's a lot in the curriculum about that, so I'm not going to reiterate any of that, but I want to just highlight. While we may look to money for meanings and messages, from happiness to worth, money serves in relationships as a tangible focus of individual and couples' issues. Divorcing couples were surveyed, and the number who cited financial disagreements as the cause of divorce was a whopping 90%. Money is seen as the number one reason that marriages, businesses, and partnerships fail. Now, the flip side of believing that money will solve all your problems is that believing that money is the primary cause of most of your troubles. Pain seeks money as remedy. It's a tangible focus. It's a Rorschach. Any discomfort seeks money as a universal solace. Like any addiction, it's a promise never kept. Money can't provide what it represents, can't redeem unhealthy beliefs, can't remedy social issues. If money is a struggle for a couple and they seem to have serious disagreement about money, examine the issues and the underlying beliefs. For example, one of the partner's brains is wired to see money as security and wants to place money in secure savings like bonds and savings accounts. The other is wired to see money as freedom and wants growth and to take more risk. The conflict isn't about money. It's about the definitions and beliefs of security and autonomy. So it's really about how two people's brains are wired quite differently, and it only hitchhikes on money. So here are some additional thoughts about working with couples, some considerations I believe that are important. The couple, the relationship, is the client. You don't have two individual clients. You have one client, the relationship. There is no confidentiality with one partner regarding the other. There is absolute confidentiality for your client, the couple. Build a holding environment, a container for the work that is safe and respectable, that houses listening and builds trust, just like with an individual client. This container requires ground rules and boundaries with active involvement of the coach to establish them. Most important is to establish a process, a format for respect, listening, waiting for the other to finish, checking in, and understanding. We don't advocate for either person, but for the couple. You see in the curriculum the us story. Guess who you know and love that that's really about? I'm coming up on my 10th anniversary with Carly. That story is about our story and beginning our relationship. We listen for strengths to build on, to use for repair. We counter the number one defense couples use of blaming each other by holding the couple accountable and responsible to be respectful in the relationship. Mentoring couples includes the fundamental components of individual coaching, though focused on the couple as the unit, the relationship itself as the client. So, same thing in individual, as an individual coach, establish the coaching alliance and develop the unfolding coaching relationship with your client, the relationship itself. The mentor must also appreciate the developmental evolution of a relationship, the stages of development of the relationship, and how they parallel the individual developmental stages of growth. And each of the individual's developmental stages, as we talked about in a career. For example, both external core issues and internal core issues affect the couple. For example, external matters like parents, family members, children, career, money, religion, neighborhood. Internal core issues such as ideals, individual styles, temperament, money psychology, personal habits, health issues, individual needs and differences, personality styles, work and performance styles. For both internal and external issues, remember, the issue is the relationship, and that's what you're hoping to develop. Now, let's look at any questions or thoughts that you have, anything you'd like to clarify or elaborate on. Clarifications or questions first from anyone? What are your thoughts about what we just talked about in this way of looking at things? I know it's become familiar by now, but to put it together as a composite, what's your take on that? Anyone? Or just any questions that you have about anything I said that may not have completely made sense or that you'd like to elaborate a bit about or anything you want to bring up in terms of your own experiences or a case. We have just a few minutes left.
I'm not sure that I have a question. It's Cheryl. But I like the reframe about the us and working on the relationship, because what I find and what I see and what I'm experiencing currently is there seems to be a lot of position taking and sides and each individual looking at each other or pointing fingers as opposed to looking at the relationship us. I don't know if I'm formulating my observation the way I want to, but I'm just liking the reframe that's starting to formulate in my mind about that.
Well, there's no question that each person in a relationship can get all kinds of people lined up behind them because they've told their story, and of course,
yes,
their story is right, and all the people that all their buddies that line up behind them are
mm-hmm.
going to go with them, and the other partner has all buddies lined up behind, and they believe that story. So, you know, it's the same process. It's the same process whether it's two people or the whole slew of seen and unseen, visible and invisible cohorts that go along with the story. the position that we take is unique, and that we're not taking sides. We are advocating for the relationship, and the relationship is mutual, complementary, and collaborative. It's not one of sides. The taking of sides is a breakdown product. So we want to distinguish what's authentic in developing a relationship versus what are the breakdown products. And a focus on money is often a breakdown product, a signal that something's gone wrong and is looking on something to hitchhike on, to land on, that makes it make conscious and logical sense so you can argue about it, or so that it can seem like it's logical and that it makes sense. You know, we're constantly looking for things of the unseen and of our energy fields and things that are less than tangible. We're looking for something for it to light on that makes it make sense, and that we can then engage in a logical and conscious way, because that way we've created closure. So what we're doing in working with a couple is to perturbate that system and not go with the fundamental assumptions that it's exactly what, but to create a different beginning, one of collaboration, and mm-hmm. one that follows some of the fundamental principles of communication that you see in the module, the basic aspects of communication and of understanding the other's position, and taking that empathic position first before stating your own position. Now, is that kind of what you were mentioning about the difference in working in this way as opposed to what we're seeing as someone comes in, for example?
I think so.
Okay. Tell me more then.
You know what? I'm not actually sure. I'm still formulating it in my mind.
Okay.
I guess what I observe in with my own relationship and what I observe around me is people taking, it's not even the gathering of allies, but so much as each person is taking their position, but they're not looking at the relationship as the us. It's you and me.
Uh-huh.
It's not us. And that's the big aha that I've kind of had, is that it's that entity, it's almost that third entity of the relationship that needs the focus, not the mm-hmm. you and me versus each other.
Yeah, you know, what we tend to do when we're tired, what we tend to do when there's emotion involved, is to get more entrenched in our fundamental position, our
mm-hmm.
default mode, and to be less flexible, less looking at things in a different way. So this natural position to look at things from our point of view, if things even begin to get charged, and in a relationship, you know some of the triggers of the other person because you've probably been responsible for installing a few of them, and they with you. So you know those triggers. You know what you
yep.
can touch on if you want to divert things into a usual, you know, fireball of discussion. So with this awareness, then a very different point of reference, rather than the point of reference of getting more entrenched and more internal, the point of reference is to move to that superordinate position of the us, the position that hasn't maybe been fully developed, to listen from that perspective, to move together to that perspective, and to see what it's like to inhabit that, what it's like to stay there for a while. And each time the stay may get a little bit easier in approximating it, it may be a bit longer, it may be something that can be returned to a bit more easily, until that also can become the default mode and become a partner in collaborations going forward. And that superordinate us position looks at the relationship as an entity of value, as an entity that develops its own wisdom that is independent of each person and their position. You know, what would the superordinate us say about this? We can develop that wisdom together by looking at things from that perspective. So it's a potential space that one can occupy. It's analogous in a way to the intersubjective space that when two people are in a relationship, this has been studied in psychoanalysis, when there are two people in a relationship, there's a superordinate third, a third that engage together to analyze one person. And often the analyst engages in analysis to be sure that there's sticking to the point. But that intersubjective space is the other, the third, that is that relationship and is that joined space. Same principle in a relationship with two people doing that, and the coach then joins in creating that space. And it's a crucible in which there can be more and more that happens as that process gets richer and deeper and fully developed. Well, we're out of time. Thank you all very much. And I terrific discussion, case presentations. I appreciate it very much. Look forward to picking up with you next time. Bye now. Have a great rest of the
week. Bye-bye.
See you.
Thank you, Dave.
See you. Absolutely.
Bye-bye.